Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, Jared Kimber here again on Wagon Wheel to answer all your questions and to start with everyone on Patreon. But if you are in the YouTube chat live, the best way to ask a question, of course, is via, what's it called now? Super Chats. I should know all these things, shouldn't I? I know nothing. Completely useless in almost every way. But I can answer questions on cricket, and that is the one thing that I'm here to do today. So I will do that to the best of my ability. We've got a lot on Patreon, so I probably won't get too many from the chat room unless there are some actual super chats in there. But if you have any super chats, feel free to pop them in. But let us start with Emron, who says, for the World Test Championship, do you think when they are playing a longer series, i.e. more than three matches, should we allow for games which have been rained out to be removed from the equation? look, this is a really long question. The truth is that the World Test Championship doesn't make any sense. And I get multiple messages every week with people coming up with better versions of it. Of course, a drunk monkey could come up with a better version of the World Test Championship than what we have. Imran, I'm sure what you're saying makes sense as well. It's not how they want to do it. They don't want it to be a proper competition. They don't want the ICC to run it correctly. They don't want it to be something that actually sustains or adds to their schedules or is better. India doesn't want to have to play Pakistan, for instance, right? The bigger teams don't want to have to play the smaller teams that often. All these things, I think it was Andrew McDonald who said all the test series should be a minimum of three tests, not two. Again, perfectly respectable way of looking at it. They're not making any money off it. And they're not making any money off it because it's not a real competition. It's not real competition because they don't want it to be a real competition. So there are many different ways that you can look at stuff like this. But it's not going to happen because they won't put the power to the ICC. They won't allow it to be a real competition because that would dilute the power of the individual cricket boards. So we're in a situation where we all know it's a flawed, stupid thing. You know, I suppose, welcome to cricket. Manon says, how do players get better at facing pace as they grow up? Do you get more used to it or is it something you can work on? There's two ways of answering this, Manon. The first one is that there is, you know, without doubt, probably a limit around 70 to 75 miles an hour. That's about the point where you have to be able to, saccade. You have to do a saccade with your eyes, which is essentially as the ball comes out of the bowler's hand, you have to then look at where it's going to land rather than following the ball because the ball's moving too fast for you to follow the ball. That is the bit that I don't think anyone can work out. And if I could work out a way of training people on how to do it, I'd be off making millions of dollars for all those guys who look great in the nets who struggle when they get to the next level, especially against bowling machines. But the next step up is that if you are facing, you know, top-end pace and you face it a lot, there are little things that you can do. So, for instance, if you're facing someone like Mark Wood, you'll listen to batters and they'll say things along the lines of that they're trying to minimize their options. So instead of sitting there and going, well, I can play the cover drive, I can play the cut shot, you know, I like to flick the ball off my pads. If it's short, I'll pull it. Whatever those major shots will be, you know, everyone will have slightly different shots that they will rely on. Against Mark Wood, you might think to yourself, okay, well, he's probably going to bowl this line and this length. So if he is, if he's bowling back of a length, I have, you know, the ability to maybe either cut him or punch him through the offside. So if he gives me any width, I'm going to go that way. And if he goes a little bit too straight and or or whatever it may be, I flick him off my hip. And I'm going to know that those are my two options coming in. And if he bowls me any other ball, I'll just go to a defensive option. That's generally what people do at top pace. They try and minimize their options because against very fast bowlers, if you do have one or two shots, you can still score really quickly against them because they're generally not as accurate and they come off the bat a lot quicker as well. So that's generally what people do at that top level of pace. You know, the best way, of course, of practicing all this is to face fast bowlers. Throwdowns don't do it. Bowling machines don't do it. You really have to find fast bowlers, and there aren't that many fast bowlers. So it's not a particularly easy thing to practice for. That's in case, Ben, and you are looking at practicing for that. Satchmo says, were you surprised that Australia never found a way to consistently restrict England's scoring rates, or was it an inevitable outcome of how England prepared for pitches to favour their batters? Well, I think if you've got a team who are going to play attacking, then they're going to be attacking regardless. So I don't think, like, I wasn't sitting there going, oh, you know, Australia's big problem here is that they haven't found a way to slow down England, because they shouldn't have found a way to slow down England until you've bowled them out. That's kind of how England is playing. It's how they play their white ball cricket. I think my bigger issue with Australia was Zach Crawley. They should have known the line and length to bowl to him. And weirdly enough, they had bowlers in their team doing that. And then they had bowlers in their team not doing that. The ones who didn't do it, didn't do very well against him, right? Ben Duckett, we knew exactly where we were supposed to bowl to him as a cricket community, whether it be Simon Hughes or Ulrich Norkia or me. We've all mentioned it. You bowl back of the length, outside of stump consistently, and he will edge. And have a look how many full balls, how many different deliveries they bowled to him over and over again that they didn't need to bowl. Who's the other one that I thought they had an issue with? I've forgotten who the other one was, but there was a third one that I thought was really obvious as well. So they're going to score fast because they're trying to score fast. So the only way to get them out the only way to stop them really is to dismiss them. Yeah, the pitches were slightly flatter. These weren't, I've seen some people talk about how flat these pitches were. They weren't English pitches in that the ball wasn't, you know, moving around off the wobble seam everywhere all the time or seaming everywhere all the time. But they certainly weren't great batting pitches, I didn't think. I wasn't sitting there going, there was probably a couple of points in a couple of the test matches where I thought this is flattened out at times. But I wasn't sitting there going, these are very, very flat batting pitches. So I think from that point of view, Australia had plenty of opportunity. I just don't think they were particularly smart. I do think that Australian cricket has a theory is the wrong way of putting it, has a mindset at times that if we're better, we'll just be better. We've got the better batters and the better bowlers. We'll just do that. Whereas I think, you know, you see some of the other teams like, New Zealand's a famous one for this of, no, we're going to play to the opposition. We're going to play specifically just what we're good at. We're going to be smart here. We're going to come up with alternate plans. And, you know, you talk to New Zealand cricketers and they'll say, well, we had to do that. We weren't as good. Australia's never really been in that position consistently. I just thought England played smarter cricket than Australia many, many times in this series. Jake says, what was the general perception of the first year in Major League Cricket in the US? Do organizers consider it a success? I'm sure they will, regardless. I haven't talked to them directly yet. You know, it only finished a couple of days ago. I thought I'd let them all sleep for a few days before I start bothering them. I'll try and get Justin on, who ran the league, to talk about it specifically on the podcast. I think from watching it from my vantage point, it went ahead. So that's a success. There were people at the ground. That was a success. It didn't really get, I don't think, casual fans outside of hardcore T20 fans that excited. I don't think it was ever going to do that. It's really more about how it energizes the US base and everything else. But from my vantage point, it seemed like a success. It could have not existed. Even for all the money they got, there were definitely huge issues going on at different times. And so it could have just not existed. The fact that it ends up with, you know, I saw the Nicholas Perrin innings get mentioned quite a bit. For me, I think that on its own is a success. We don't always see that with those tournaments. Prashant says, who according to you is the cleanest striker of the cricket ball in the history of the game? Trumper, Gilchrist, Durrani, Harmanpreet. Durrani, that's a nice pull. Who is the best ball striker in the modern game? How would you measure the same in the game? Clean strike is a weird one, isn't it? Because it's an interesting phrase. So I tried to do this thing a few years ago with T20 cricket where I said that there were the sort of muscular batters. So Andre Russell, Corey Anderson, Chris Lynn, who used their physicality to hit sixes. And even when they didn't get all of it, it still went for six. And then, but you had a lot of sort of Martin Guptill, Yuvraj Singh type players who were brilliant timers of a ball, but weren't necessarily, you know, big, huge, masculine strikers. They were kind of, they needed to find the middle of the bat, but when they did find the middle of the bat, I thought that was, you know, the way that they did was absolutely incredible. So I would think of that as someone who's a clean striker of the ball, but I'm not sure if that's your thinking of a clean striker of the ball, Prashant. So that to me is someone who, I remember seeing a footage once of Ian Chappell hitting a six in at the MCG in a one day game, straight down the ground. And I watched him and I thought, oh, he probably wouldn't have hit a lot of sixes, but I bet you when, you know, when he was timing the ball really well, he could probably have put a few over the fence. And that was, it was all about the cleanness of the way that he sort of played his straight drives. For me, I think Yuvraj is the player that always reminded me of that. I always felt that when the ball hit Yuvraj's middle, it just went further than anyone else's. There was, it had this sort of rebounding effect off his bat, almost like his bat was more, I don't know, rubbery or like a corked bat in baseball or something like that. So he's a name that instantly comes to mind. I suppose you'd need to put Albert Trott in this as someone who, you know, if not cleared the Lord's Pavilion, then certainly put a ding somewhere up into the Lord's Pavilion at one stage with a very, very old bat. Although it should be noted that by that stage, bat design was much better than it often gets credit for, as the test that the MCC did a couple of years ago, the middle of those old bats are pretty much as good as the middle of those current bats. The difference was everything else. Yeah, so I suppose those are the people I think of as the cleaner striker. Hamerpreet's a really interesting one from the women's game. Alyssa Healy might be another one as well. And I would have thought, outside of someone like Lizelle Lee, that a lot of the women are probably more cleaner strikers of the ball just because they need that extra timing in a way that, you know, some of the other players don't. But yeah, it's quite a subjective one, Prasant. So I'm not sure I can answer that perfectly for you. But Yuvraj, when I read that, Yuvraj was the name that instantly came to mind from that point of view. Swami Nathan says, is there a definitive proof that diving to make your ground is a better idea than running on a straight line? Did diving evolve as a strategy confuse the umpire in the days of pre-third umpire? I think the idea that is, it's the same as sprinters when they're running, right? Of bending themselves over. You are getting closer to the crease by doing that. I think it was either Bob Wilmer or Cricket Australia did a very brief test once, and it was certainly, it showed that you could get back a little bit quicker by diving than by running. And as far as I'm aware, that's the only, everything else would be anecdotal. But I do believe that a very, very, I don't want to say amateur test, but a very, very not quite professional, scientific study, maybe is the best way of putting it, felt that that was the case. But if you've played it just and you dive, it does feel like you're more likely to get back in than just by running. And I think maybe that's all it is. But I don't think it has anything to do with the third umpire days, because diving's very modern part of cricket, really. Diving, people aren't diving for their crease up until the 90s, I want to say. I think it's probably the Australians and maybe the South Africans to kind of make that a major thing. It's not that players hadn't, you know, sometimes just through pure desperation, but it wasn't as a normal thing in the history of cricket as it certainly is now. So I don't think it was a pre-DRS thing or a pre-third umpire thing. Ben says, why don't left arm quicks and right arms to lefties bowl more off cutters? In theory, the easiest cuts of the bowl, wider the crease angle in, cut away, like facing SLA at high pace. They wouldn't need much movement at all. With the bat pad, they could cover both edges. Yeah, totally agree. Mitchell Johnson was the first guy I kind of saw as a left arm bowler who seemed to really focus on this. And I thought he was brilliant. In fact, I've never talked to him about this, but I'd love to go back and have a chat to him about one time. But I thought it was when he was at his best, other than when he was at his absolute fastest. So I remember him bowling around the wicket off cutters, you know, at 135 kilometers an hour and just looking unplayable. I think at that stage, his arm was a little bit lower. And so that made it a little bit easier to get maybe more revs on the ball or, you know, help with the angle or whatever it may be that made it tougher on the batters. And then afterwards, his arm maybe got a little bit higher for a while. And then he started bowling, you know, 93 miles an hour, and it didn't really matter as much anymore after that, you know, when he could consistently bowl at pace. But yeah, I've talked about it with Mustafiza as well when he has bowled around the wicket cutters. I think we're starting to see it with Trent Bolt started to bowl the three-quarter seam wobble ball, which is not quite a cutter, but more like a cutter, halfway between a cutter and a wobble ball, I suppose. We started to see Mitchell Starc do it. But I agree with you with right armers. I used to do this all the time. I would play with my friends and, you know, you bowl your leg spin for ages and you know, you bowl to left-handers and they whack you everywhere. And if they could pick the wrong one, they're absolutely useless. And you just bowl medium pace around the wicket to them and just roll your fingers over the side of it. And they found it really, really tough. For me, yeah, I'm completely on board with this. I don't really understand why it isn't something that people do more often. What I would say is that, you know, Kemar Roach, Stuart Broad, is it Ishan Sharma was another one, I think, because they naturally took the ball away from left-handers. They have started to do it, obviously, through the air and with wobble ball. But I agree. I think the next stage of it is, you know, especially if you can bowl 145 kilometers an hour, you should be able to bowl cutters around 130, 133 kilometers an hour around the wicket. I think it's a really good idea. I suppose that the one thing I would say is if you are, and I've never bowled them at pace, but I would assume if you're bowling them at pace, there is a certain point at which you are, I mean, this is what happened to Mustafiza, right? You know, your wrist, your elbow, your shoulder, whichever one is the pressure point for you, may get injured because you are still bowling, you're still rolling your arm over at maximum pace, but you're also now putting, you know, revolutions on the ball through these other pressure points. So I don't know if that is a reason why people don't do it all day at top end pace. But based on the Bob Appleyard story, who was a bowler who obviously put a lot of revolutions on the ball for a seam bowler in his era, I would suggest that that is the case. But I don't know. It's a great question, and I think they should do it more often. I also think that women who swing the ball in a long way to right-handers should bowl around the wicket. And I know some of them have practiced this, and they don't think they can do it properly. But I don't know. It feels like another angle that would be nearly unplayable. Will says, do you think that concentrating the Ashes in June and July actually worked in retrospect by keeping away from football? I don't know if I'm the right person to ask about this, Will, based on the fact that whether football's on or not, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not sure I would even have that on my radar, right? So, okay, there was no football on. Maybe that helps. I've got no problem with the Ashes being played in June or July. I don't necessarily see why they have to be in August or into early September or anything else. I think moving them for the 100 is a bit different because you would take away something that is your major money earner for something else that is not quite your major money earner at the moment. So it'd be a bit like, I always go to McDonald's for this. This is always my number one, but it would be a little bit like saying we're not going to advertise the Big Mac anymore, and we're going to move it to a smaller part of the menu that's harder to see. But we're going to advertise all the other major things. And the other burgers don't actually make up as many sales as the Big Mac over time. I'm not saying that what will happen because the 100 might take over and might end up making, or not the 100, but a league, if not the 100 in England, might end up making a lot more money than the Ashes. But as it currently stands, it's like, shouldn't you be making the 100 prove itself first rather than kind of doing it backwards? A similar thing happened with the Big Bash, where in the Big Bash, they kind of stuffed it up and they put both up against each other. I always thought if they just believed in the Big Bash, which they thoroughly did, I actually thought it would be better off to put it in a part of the year that is not as cricket dependent so that you can own that space and actually stretch out how long you are popular for. Anyway. That's a whole different one. We'll have a break here. And then after the break, I will get to a few more questions on Wagon Wheel with Jared Kimball.
Get ready to take charge of your favorite leagues in Wicket Cricket Manager. Control the game, buy and sell players, and train them to victory. Play against friends, strangers, or challenge yourself. With your cricket knowledge, become the master on the pitch of Wicket Cricket Manager.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like, maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live, because you shouldn't have to change teams even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto renews.
All right, welcome back. Swami Nathan says, as a selector, should you play the long game of picking youngsters? Alternatively, should you pick players in their 30s like Chris Rogers and Skies to get half a decade worth of good performance? What goes into such decision-making processes? So there's no right answer for any of these things, right? I think that generally people want the next big exciting thing. And if that's the case for fans, I think that's also the case for people with inside cricket and selectors and everyone else involved. But my thing would often be that you put yourself in a situation there where, let's say you pick someone at the age of 20 because you know that they're a 10-year player, but it might also take them 3 years to get to that 10-year player status. Is it worth them having 3 years of underperforming? And I don't think that question is ever asked enough. The second thing is, if they do underperform for 3 years and then you think to yourself, oh, they're not actually a 10-year player, have you also invested poorly in them, or have you made a mistake and they're about to get a lot better and then you drop them? And so I do worry about all those sorts of things. I'd much rather see with younger players, and a lot of this, I've talked about this a lot, but in cricket, we're so obsessed with the 11. I'd love for a period of, you've got 2 years of test matches coming up. Let's say you've got 16 test matches in that time. I'd love for you to go to 20 players at that stage and say, okay, this is how we're going to work it out. We might want a couple of extra experienced players on this tour. We might want a couple of extra younger players on this tour. We've got a really good young batter here, but he's not going to play all the test matches. Even if he does well, we're going to take him in. We're going to bring him in. We're going to send him off on some other tours, get some other experience, all these sorts of things. But instead, it's like you're either in the 11 or you're not in the 11, right? You know, and once you're dropped, you're on the verge of never being seen for a long period of time. I think that's where cricket has its biggest issues. And that's because it's never been a substitution sport. So the 11 is the most important thing, but we don't think about things correctly. So from that point of view, I think that's where the issues come in. If Chris Rogers is the best opening batter in the world and he's 29 years old or 31 years old or 33 years old, why would you not pick him? And I've never truly understood the logic behind that of, well, we might only get a couple of years. Yeah, but if you're going to get a couple of years of someone being well above replacement level, and you've got another, let's say you have an option between Renshaw and Rogers. By the time they were going to pick Rogers, they knew that he was steady as you go. They probably thought he was going to average between 40 and 45, well above what a normal opener would have averaged in that period, right? He'd been tested. They knew everything that they needed to know about him. Renshaw, they picked on a whim, right? And I still think Renshaw is a really, really talented player. But it was quite clear within three innings, that Renshaw had deficiencies within his game that were going to need to be fixed. So your question at that point is what you do next. And if you really believe in Renshaw, which I don't think they did at that stage, you could continue to pick him, knowing that he might average 30 to 35 over a, you know, 3 or 4 year period, and then you hope that he comes good after that. So are you willing to have a below average opener for 3 to 5 years while Renshaw gets good? If you don't have another opener out there, then I think that's fine. Like if you look at Australian cricket now, they've got Bancroft, Harris, and an older Renshaw who might be the one of the three openers. They might, if they had a 20-year-old coming through now, they might be like, look, none of those guys is probably going to average above 40 in test match cricket. If we bring a younger player in, he might average slightly less than them. But because we bring him in, we have the ability to develop him so that when the decade after that first 3 to 5 years, he might be one of the world's best openers. I think that's a really, really important thing. The question I have is this idea that because you pick someone as your opener, they're your opener in all places and everywhere, is where cricket gets it wrong, right? It isn't whether we pick young players or old players. Yet those problems happen in all sports. Where we specifically get it wrong is we pick an opener and we say, well, you're going to be able to open in India and Pakistan and Sri Lanka and Bangladesh, and you're going to be able to open in New Zealand and the West Indies and South Africa and Australia and England. What? Those are completely different jobs, right? So the best thing is if you find a young player to go, okay, so what do they do good now? Okay, so this guy is brilliant at the lateral moving ball on, you know, when it's swinging and seaming. So let's take him to New Zealand, South Africa, England, and let's see how he goes there. How's he going to face? He's not particularly good against spin yet, and we're really worried about him specifically against the hard skiddy ball when it spins. All right, let's not take him there straight away. Let's either take him in the nets and let him face a bunch of good net bowlers with rock hard balls so he can start to work out what he's doing, or let's put him in a bunch of tour games where he has to go and face players in Sri Lanka and in India and in any other situation like that where he's going to have to face that kind of thing. That is how you should develop young players, right? And what you should use the older players for is filling in all those gaps. And when so I would say that far too often in Test match cricket, you don't have your best 11 playing because you won't pick an older player because he's 32 and you're not sure about him. And you'll pick a player that you know is not ready yet because he played in another venue against another team and did well. You've got to be smarter than that. And I do think there's a way that that can be done. Will says, have you found covering the Ashes as a commentator freelancer rather than from mainstream site? Or how have you found, sorry, rather than a mainstream site like Cricket Info? Look, the biggest difference is that you know, I just did that big piece on Stuart Broad. And I think it's a really good piece and I'm really proud of it. When you write it for yourself as a freelancer, it gets a few hits, but it's very rare do you go viral. Very rare do, you know, celebrities who follow Cricket Info tweet about it. Do players who, you know, dislike it or like it tweet about it. The only people who follow it are your direct audience. So you are, when I was writing for Cricket Info, I felt like I was writing, when you were doing stuff, you're doing it for a really wide cricket loving audience. And when you're writing for my kind of network, so people like you and, you know, the YouTube and the emailer and the podcasts, all the different things that we do in my network, I kind of feel like I'm doing it for people who like our stuff. That doesn't mean that we won't continue to grow, but it doesn't have that moment. So I remember, you know, writing a piece at the end of it, when you wrote a piece for Cricket Info that you knew was a really good piece, you had this like adrenaline of going back to your Twitter, you know, an hour after it was published and seeing the energy from your piece get matched by people on Twitter or Facebook or wherever they were sharing it. And that doesn't happen when it's on your own thing. So it's a very different, you know, I'm running for a very, very small audience compared to a website that has, what, 40 million users. So from that point of view, it's very different. Commentating, it's interesting because I've been commentating for SEN and SENZ in Australia and New Zealand. You know, the majority of people who are probably following the cricket late at night are either, you know, a small handful will be listening on the radio because they're working at night or they're, you know, they listen to the radio as they try and fall asleep. And the rest of the people, if they're up, are probably just going to be watching it on TV. So it's a really small audience that you are playing to. Whereas when you're commentating a series during the daytime, people are commuting all the time or they're working in their office and they can't have their cricket screen up, right? So they have to listen to the radio. So it's a, you know, it's very, very different. From a time perspective, commentating and writing and making a video and planning your podcast is quite a hectic day. So again, that's very different than Cricket Info, where most of the work I would do would be towards the end of the day from that perspective and then, you know, have to go about it from there. But look, the big difference for me is even if I don't get the, you know, 100,000 reads on a piece or whatever it may be that you used to get with Cricket Info, what happens now is everything I build goes back to me. Right. And so that is very, very different from that point of view. So, I mean, it's all over this. Would spinners like Harbhajan and Kumble have much better records than Ashwin if they had DRS, or is Ashwin the undisputed GOAT? Would they have much better records? Well, they still bowled on really flat wickets. I think you have to be honest in that and say that, you know, the average runs per wicket in Kumble's era was absolutely nothing like Ashwin's, right? So it isn't just about that. You know, Warne and Murali didn't have DRS, right? And they both have fantastic records. And they were both better bowlers than Harbhajan. I also think that Ashwin probably travels better than Harbhajan or Kumble. Although there's maybe not as much of a difference between Kumble and Ashwin. But, I think you have to factor all that in. They would be different bowlers if they had DRS. And that is the same of Bisham Baby and Tiger Bill O'Reilly and Clary Grimmett. Every spinner in the world before DRS bowled in a different way. And they had to bowl in a different way. They generally bowled slower because they had to suck the batters out of the crease, right? They had to manufacture wickets in a way that modern spinners don't really have to. Modern spinners attack the stumps. It's very rare now to see a spinner bowling for a court behind. Doesn't mean that they won't have, you know, one or two slips in place and everything else. But even when they're doing that, they're not bowling outside off stump and spinning it away unless there's footmarks. They're generally bowling at the stumps at all times, because even if they are hopeful to get a caught behind or a corded slip, anything that doesn't spin, or their slider or whatever it may be, any variation they have, needs to go on to be able to hit the stumps. So you have to keep the stumps in play an awful lot more. So Harbhajan and Kumble would be very, very different bowlers if they bowled now. Harbhajan bowled wide of the crease for an off spinner, and that probably played against him in the pre-DRS era. As now we know a lot more about, you know, LBWs, I think he would have got more. Kumble bowled very, very stump to stump, and bowled fast. So he bowled in a DRS method already. I don't think he would have had to. I think both of them actually probably bowl in a way that would have helped DRS. They probably kept the stumps in play more than some of the other spinners out there. You know, that, you know, someone like Stuart McGill probably bowled wider of the stump a little bit more than those guys did. So I don't think there would have been massive tweaks to their game, but they would have been different. But I think the bigger difference isn't the DRS, because these guys still took lots of wickets. They just took, I kind of think the old-fashioned spinners took wickets in a varied way, whereas the new-fashioned spinners take wickets in a very narrow way, which is what these guys would have done if they bowled in this era as well. But yeah, I think the bigger difference, for if you're picking those three players, is the pitches. I mean, you know, I think Ashwin's a better bowler than Kumble, and you won't find many people who rate Kumble higher than I do, but I think Ashwin is a better bowler than Kumble, but Kumble was incredible as well. Vivek says, well, Wokeson would the most influential bowlers across the two teams in the series. Yeah, I suppose the only other one would be Stark in the Ashes. He was very, very influential as well. I mean, I didn't think coming into this Ashes that he would have much of a say, so him bowling as well as he did, certainly, there was certainly something to be said for Stokes, Stark. You know, that new delivery that I don't think England was really that ready for. I thought he was really good. Cummins just got tired. Hazelwood still looks half fit. Obviously, Anderson and Broad bowled well, Anderson not so well. But Wokes and Wood, I mean, although Wood was pretty much toast by the end, but Wokes and Wood probably had the most impact. But maybe they didn't bowl on some of the flatter wickets as well. They certainly didn't bowl on Edgbaston, did they? Which would have tested them both. I'm not sure how Wokes would have gone at Lords. I think Wood might have gone okay at Lords, though. But yes, I think it's fair to say. But yeah, sometimes that happens when you play minimum tests and you play on the right kinds of surfaces. Vikas says, would you say Sky's commentary team is the best in the world? I always enjoy their coverage. On the other hand, I always find Indian coverage very boring. Sky, the best in the world. Yes, I would probably say they're the I still think they have their issues. In fact, I'm doing something on this at the moment, but I think they should trust non-former players more. I think it becomes a bit of a former players boys club. They're not particularly good at the journalism, even though they've got guys like Nasser and Athers who are obviously slightly more journalistic. And by that, I mean they at least write columns, or in Athers' case, they write columns. Nasser speaks his column to a ghost person, but he's still thinking about columns all the way through. But they're not journalists, and I don't think they particularly think like journalists. And I think that is a very important part of broadcast. And I would say if they were missing anything, it's that. But everyone's missing that, because no one picks, well, not just journalists, but broadcasters. But the professional broadcasters think in a different way than former players do. And I think that is missing from Sky. But as I said, that's kind of missing from everywhere, on TV especially. So I don't think from that point of view that there's that makes them any worse than anywhere else. I can't think of another commentary team that is as consistently as a high quality as them. A lot of really good commentators come and go. You're now starting to see people like, I've always said that I thought this was, I think it's a very much a learned skill, especially for former players. If you go back and listen to the Channel 9 team in the 80s, they weren't very good. And you listen to them in the 90s and they are tip top. That was because they had great production around them. The producers were really harsh on them, made them learn, made them get better. And if you look at someone like Simon Dool, I think Simon Dool is a really good example of someone whose commentary has got better by consistently commentating. And there's so many other people that could be good in the world, broadcasters and former players and journalists and commentators, all these different things, who could be much better than they are if they were given a long run and if they were given great production around them. And sadly, that's not how cricket is done. So Sky is probably one of the few that has it's a very closed shop, Sky. It's very hard to get a job on it, although Stuart Broad is about to get one, of course. But you know what I mean? It's not like some of the other places where people sort of pop in and pop out and anything like that. It's very, very closed. That the team doesn't change very much from year to year. They know what they want to do. And most other commentaries are just not like that, right? And I think that's a big part of why they're better than everyone else. Ian says, after his exceptional contribution in the last three tests and home record in general, is Chris Woakes guaranteed to go to India, or will England be brave enough to deny that with a 35-year-old that is unlikely to suddenly master bowling abroad? Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I floated this out. I think, Ian, you might have even been on the Discord channel when we were talking about that, which you can join via our Patreon. And I talked to some people in the press box as well, and it was really split. We couldn't work out whether this means he goes to India or not, because he shouldn't go to India, because I don't think his skills directly translate there. But because he bats, it means that they're always trying to sort of force Woakes a little bit more into situations than he should have. I don't see how any of the skills that he has as a bowler translate to India. I'd happily be wrong, and hopefully he does quite well. Yeah, he's a fantastic player. He's so underrated, I think, in some ways, although his overseas record probably is the majority of the reason why he is underrated. But I don't see how he can play in India, no. And I think they're smart enough not to take him. I think that's right. Where am I? Manon says, some guys like Warner use new bats super often versus other guys who keep using a bat until it's basically unusable. What's the science behind it? Or is it just each of their own? It's more about feel, I think. There are a lot of players who like the feel of a new bat. There are a lot of other players who trust a bat. So once they know it's a very good bat, they're going to use it until, as you say, it falls apart. I think that just depends on the player. I think the guys who hit the ball harder, from my experience, tend to be happier with changing bats. And I think they're just more used to changing bats. Whereas the guys who, to go back to the proper strikers of the ball, their bats probably last a little bit longer because they're not trying to muscle the ball away as much. They're not swinging as hard. So I do think from that point of view that those are the sort of players you probably see that will use a bat and trust a bat. Whereas hitters break bats so often that they're not as sentimental or as, maybe sentimental is the wrong word, but they don't believe in the magic voodoo of a bat, because every time they get a good bat, it breaks after three innings anyway, or breaks after a couple of good net sessions. So I do think from that point of view, but a lot of it is just to do with feel, right? Like if you find a bat that feels really good in your hands, you get a bat maker to make the exact same kind of bat, but that's not how wood works, right? And so there's not much you can do. It just does feel differently to you. So I think there are some players who feel that way. To go back to Chris Rogers' arm guard as a perfect example of maybe a bit of kit that he could have replaced. Emran says, for the world to... Oh, we've already done that one. Don't know why that was in there twice. Vivek's... Oh my God, we got a bunch. Sorry, everyone. Avi says, how significant is the inclusion of Pakistan players in the MLC? It's interesting. I would say this, that in America, and I don't just mean America, I mean, I probably mean England as well, maybe Australia as well, maybe the Western countries. The amount of times that I've gone to World Cup games between India and Pakistan, and there are Indian and Pakistanis there enjoying the games together, it's very different outside of India and Pakistan, that rivalry. And, in many of these places, they eat at the same kind of restaurants, right? They might pray in the same kinds of places. They might study the same kinds of courses or study at the same universities where they're, you're an immigrant from Pakistan and you're an immigrant from India. You might get together. It's very different. So I'm not overly surprised. And I remember when we had 99.94 and we had a lot of business meetings, the business meetings with the Indian people, so Indian business people who still lived in India, and the people who were Indian business people who might live in Europe or America, were very, very different from the fact that, we were talking about, how it would work with India and Pakistan and, what would happen if we got Pakistan investment into the company and all this, and in the American situation, the European situation, they were like, we don't care. If you can get it more investment, then we would be happy with that. Whereas in India, they were like, we can't have anything to do with any sort of Pakistani thing, to the point at which they never quite said, we shouldn't do a 99.94 podcast channel for Pakistan, but that they wouldn't have wanted particularly linked with the Indian. They, you know, probably wouldn't have won a crossover episode after a World Cup as well. We probably would have done it anyway. But there were some investors who thought towards that, so to say. And they never said it from their point of view. They were always like, this is how other people would feel. And maybe they're right. But it was a little bit different. Whereas in America, that is not the case. And so I'm not overly surprised. There are certainly some team owners. And remember, there are probably some teams that are not going to have Pakistani players and some teams that will. I always said to the people that I worked for in these sorts of situations, it's very, very simple. If there are eight team owners and four of them are not buying Pakistani players and four are, then you should be able to get the Pakistani players cheaper and more quality available to you by embracing that. So it's up to you and your own personal politics what you want to do. But I certainly worked for, you know, a team that owns an IPL franchise at one stage who said to me, no Pakistani players at all. And I've, you know, been involved with other teams who've said, look, we're open to Pakistani players, you know, depending on the situation. So it's not massively surprising to me that in an American cricket league, you would have them. It would actually, from a political side of things, make it really, really awkward in America if one nation was, you know, excluded. Right? Like from a diversity point of view, from a coverage point of view, from Major League Cricket, it actually would get a little bit icky. In cricket, we've just kind of thrown our arms up. We all know it's stupid, but we've kind of given up talking about it because it's been going on for so long now. That's not quite the case in other places. Aditya says, who would be a batting equivalent abroad? Great overall numbers, unbelievable peaks, but lacking behind on important metrics. That is a very good question. My first thought is Mahela Jayawardena. And I just want to look up his numbers to see. So Mahela, what's his overall test batting average? So the average is 49.84. I don't think you can argue he's a top 50 batter of all time. I haven't actually made my list yet. So I'm kind of doing the maths in my head on this. Let's have a look. So he averages 35 in the UK. He averages 30 across Australia and New Zealand. He averages 42 in the West Indies and 35 in Africa. I'm assuming that's against Zimbabwe. And yeah, that's against both of them. So in South Africa, he averages 27. And then in Asia, he averaged 56 with 9,399 runs. So he never made, let's have a look here. He made 11,814 runs, and of those, he made 9,399 in one place. I don't think Stuart Broad is quite the same in terms of, you know, I think Stuart Broad's got very good figures in the UAE, for instance, right? I think it's just the UAE. I think he struggled in Sri Lanka, India. I think so, and I don't know if he bowled much in Bangladesh. I'd have to go back and check that one. So he didn't travel particularly well. And so Mahela, he's got over 10,000 runs. Mahela was absolutely one of the best players of spin bowling you will ever see. And Stuart Broad could change a test match in a way that just so few players ever have before. But you do actually need to start to, I think it distances them from the other players with those sorts of counting stats when you start to break down where they was successful, or in Broad's case, you know, the overall average of 27, how long it took him to get successful, whichever that may be, right? So on pure counting stats alone, you know, Mahela's what, in the top 10 or 15 run scorers of all time? I mean, to score 9,399 runs in Asia is just mind-blowing on its own. Also, absolutely incredible how little the Sri Lankans did actually play outside of Asia, but that's a different conversation. And it comes back to Kumar's stats as well. But from that that point, I think if you start to break down Mahela piece by piece, as I said, you know, him, let's have a look, averaging, was it 33 in Australia over, no, actually, I'll start that again. 31 in Australia over 7 tests, 35 in England over 12 tests, 27 in New Zealand over 7 tests, 27 in South Africa over 8 tests. You know, West Indies is, we only played 4 tests, but he averages 42 there. Look, I think Mahela is a fantastic player. And And I actually think Stuart Broad was a fantastic player. But there is a difference between those sort of unimpeachable records where, you know, might get someone like Ricky Ponting who didn't make runs in India, right? And, you know, you might get another player who's got like, you know, one particular weird weakness, like Steve Smith in the fourth innings, right? Those sorts of very, very obvious things. But when you actually start to break down their records, it is very different. And I didn't do this for Stuart Broad because I didn't think it was fair. But if you look at Glenn McGrath, I just want to show you the difference between universal greatness universal greatness and like at players like Mahela and Broad, who are absolutely great for their country and are fantastic players, but not unimpeachable. So this is Glenn McGrath in each country, his bowling average. So in Australia, he averaged 22.4. In England, he averaged 19.3. In India, he averaged 21.3. In New Zealand, he averaged 18. In Pakistan, he averaged 31. In South Africa, he averaged 23. In Sri Lanka, he averaged 29. In the UAE, he averaged 7. It's a fun one. Only two tests, but still fun. West Indies, he averaged 20. And Zimbabwe, he averaged 15. That's not slating Mahela and Stuart Broad, but that is a player who is just obviously absolutely great. And, you know, you just have, there has to be different levels of this, right? And I don't think it's being unfair to try and what I wanted to do with Broad specifically is just try and work out where he does fit in, because I think 604 wickets on its own is a form of greatness. But if you do it with an average of 27.68 or whatever his average was, you have to then, you know, you have to start to ask bigger questions about everything else around him. And it's the same with Mahela, right? A batting average of 49 with over 10,000 runs is absolutely great. But that doesn't mean that when you break down every part of these guys' games, it goes to the same level. And that's kind of what we want to do in our work, right? You know, that piece was mine, but it could have been to do with Cheyenne or, you know, anyone else who was helping us with one of those projects. We're trying to work out, you know, the best players of all time and where they all fit in. And it's so confusing and so much fun with cricket because of the variables with pitches and everything else. But yeah, I think Mahela, when I read this question, Aditya, Mahela was the one. The only other one I thought was VVS. But the thing is that VVS doesn't end up at the top of the run scorers. I think VVS is 8,800, I want to say-ish. And it's a little bit lower again. So I don't think he's on that broad level. Whereas I think Mahela being over, you know, 11,000 runs is probably closer to that broad level. Although I think Stuart Broad's 604 wickets is harder than Mahela's 11,000 runs. Although they played a lot of short series, the Sri Lankans, didn't they? Anyway, Nirod says, after the Ireland series, Dimuth Karunaratne said he wanted to hand over test captaincy to DDS. Of course he does, because Dhananjay De Silva is a fucking god. SLC rejected this and is now forcing him to lead the test side. Does this happen in modern cricket? Yes. I mean, there's one case of it. No, it happens a bit. I always find captaincy really interesting because you don't traditionally get paid a lot more money to be captain. Some places you do, but you don't always. And I remember being around Kyron Pollard when he was a captain at Solution, just thinking to myself, he's not getting paid enough for this. Like, he's getting paid the accurate amount for his batting. If you factor in his captaincy, he should be way up here. Which is one thing that, you know, sometimes in T20 analysis, we don't really even factor in, which I think is probably a mistake. But no, you certainly hear of players all the time. You know, Quinton de Kock didn't want to be a captain, did he? Dimuth could just say no, but, you know, he's probably thinking he doesn't want to. But there are certainly players who are forced into it or encouraged to do it a little bit longer or these sorts of things. They do happen quite a bit in cricket. It's not ideal, but it's certainly something that happens. Nirwan says, how would you rate Zahir Khan compared to the current crop of Indian seamers? Akram was obviously better, but how does he compare with Vaas? Yeah, I was looking at Vaas recently. Vaas is, and I can't remember if Zahir's another one, but Vaas and I want to say, is it Cap or Dev was the other one I found? Where they were actually much better. Let me just find the stats here. Vaas and Cap or Dev were very, very good. Let's have a look if I can find it. In Americas, in Asia, 29. Yeah, so Cap or Dev averaged 39 in the UK. And I've got a feeling Chaminda Vaas had a high average there as well, which I find really fascinating because they were swing bowlers and you would have thought they would have done so well outside, you know, in those conditions, but it didn't always translate for them. I just found that fascinating from a point of view. We often say things like, oh, you know, this guy's a great Asian seam bowler, but he hasn't even got conditions in his favor. And then, you know, when you look at it, just want to see if Kapil Dev played New Zealand as well. I think he did, didn't he? He averaged 42 in New Zealand. So when the conditions were in his favor, he didn't get any better. That's because while he was a fantastic swing bowler, clearly there was something about the way that he had learned to bowl meant that he was much better in those conditions. Why am I bringing this up with Zahir Khan? So I think that in Zahir Khan's case, that he was an absolutely fantastic, I mean, a bit like Anil Kumble, I'll go to the wall for Zahir Khan because I think, again, he played in a very dead pitch era, you know, very flat pitches, and had to get the absolute most out of himself. He's ended up with an average that is going to be worse than a lot of bowlers that I believe he was probably more talented than. I'm sure there are some advanced metrics that could bring him back, great. But at the end of the day, he's not going to end up with the kind of stats that anyone else had. And I wonder if, should we just have a look at him as well? And I wonder if, again, he's a similar kind of player in that he was so good at getting the most out of himself when he bowled in Asia that he didn't translate as well as it should have in some of those overseas conditions. So he's good in England and he is good in, he's decent in England and decent in New Zealand. So he's not quite got that same issue that some of those other players do. So his record is what I would expect, actually. It's a guy who, you know, in Australia averaged 35, a little bit higher than what you want in Australia, although he's a skittier bowler, so probably not his ideal conditions. The same in South Africa. But when the ball was actually swinging in England and New Zealand, he had that. But, you know, inside of India, he's averaging 36. Whereas if you look at Chaminder Vass and Kapil Dev, they both average under 30 in those conditions. Now, how much of that was the pitches that he played on at the time? I think that's very fair to say. I thought he was one of the smarter bowlers I've seen. I love the way he went about it. I think if he bowls 6 years later in his career, you know, in the wobble ball era, he would have absolutely towered people up. But he's not. I don't think you can compare him to Vass just because Vass had an incredible career with no backup at all outside of Murali for a long period of that of his career. Obviously Akram is next level. So I don't think he's quite on that Vass level just because I do think that Vass worked out how to bowl in the unfriendliest conditions in a way that he didn't. I just want to have a look at Vass's record just quickly here. Although I spelt it incorrectly. But yeah, I just want to have a look at the overall. And this is just back of a napkin type stuff, everyone. So if you come at me later and go, well, actually he did this. But so Vass had 180 wickets in Sri Lanka, an average of 26. And didn't 111 wickets in 5 matches in India. Although I suppose Murali probably took the majority of them. But didn't take any wickets in England. Did do quite well in Sri Lanka though, Vass. So which complicates everything a little bit further there. But yeah, it's... I think all things considered, Vass probably has the better record. I still think that Zahir Khan was a better all-round bowler and that I would have wanted him in all conditions. But perhaps on a very flat pitch, there was something, a very flat Asian pitch, there's just something that Chaminder Vass could do consistently that Zahir Khan didn't. But I think on pure talent, I still think Zahir Khan was the better bowler. But I think if you're looking at their overall records, you probably have to go with Chaminder Vass. I just want to have a look at something just to go back to the Mahela conversation. So Chaminder Vass in Asia took 236 wickets. And that means he took over 100 outside of Asia. So huge difference, the percentage of wickets he took inside Asia and outside of Asia compared to Mahela's runs, which is really, really interesting as they played over a similar period. Anyway, that's everyone on the Patreon. Remember, go over and support us on Patreon. It's the best way to ask questions on this podcast. I'm going to take a break here. And then after the break, we will come back and we will do, what will we do? I will do the questions from the room. You're listening to Wagon Wheel. I am Jared Kimber. All right, welcome back. Let's get into some super chats. Oh, it helps if I actually click on one of them, doesn't it? Shrikant has sent one in. Do you think Steve Smith is underappreciated in Australia? Many pundits, Chappelli and Warne, stop short of declaring him the best since Bradman. They didn't play in his era. I mean, there is a huge part of Australian cricket that is very sort of era dependent. And like, you know, so when I started Cricket with Balls, my blog, one of the lines on the blog was, cricket blogs were better in my day. And it was by Neil Harvey, which apparently someone got a t-shirt printed up and got him to sign it once and then had to explain what a cricket blog was to him. So I do think from that perspective that, you know, there's always been that element. I don't think that's that different for anyone, really. I don't think he's underappreciated overall. I think the sandpaper thing certainly plays a part in it. And he comes after so many good cricketers. So I think that in some ways you've probably seen the same with Virat Kohli, and you haven't seen it with Kane Williamson and Joe Root, right? Whereas Kane Williamson and Joe Root, I would say Kane Williamson is probably, you know, we talked about Mahela before. Kane Williamson has a very interesting record when you start to dig very deep into it, right? You scratch at the surface and you're like, wait a minute, is he not as good as I thought he was? But in New Zealand, he has incredible plaudits because who is the best batter before him? It's a long way back to Martin Crowe, right? And so you do have a period where you then get appreciated, even overappreciated at that point, because there haven't been many other players. Joe Root, very similar. You know, their best players had been imports, right? You know, Jonathan Trott and KP, only really Alistair Cook is the one. And Alistair Cook's fantastic, but probably not quite at that Joe Root level. Although I think I could make a pretty good case for it, but I don't think he was as exciting or as dramatic, you know, in the way that Cook was because of the way that Cook played. So again, Root gets a lot of attention. Smith comes on the back of, like, when Smith enters that side, Ponting is there, right? You know, they had Hayden. They even had guys like Damien Martin and Gilchrist and, you know, all these guys with phenomenal records. You know, they had the Mike Hussey thing, had the Adam Voges thing. I don't think it's quite the same. And I think it's the same with Virat, you know, with Sachin and everyone else that was before him. So I think it's very similar from that perspective. All those things matter. I've said this before, like Herbert Sutcliffe basically gets wedged between Jack Hobbs, Bradman and Hammond. But Herbert Sutcliffe was incredible, right? Maybe he didn't play as long as, you know, some of the other guys did for, you know, obviously the war and everything else. Maybe he didn't build his legacy as much. But he was seen as like Hobbs's batting partner, right? And all those sorts of things. Whereas he was absolutely fantastic. These things happen to players. And I think that if Smith has another 2 or 3 years of batting at plus 55 average, which I'm not sure he can. I mean, hopefully for him he can, but I'm not sure that that is the case. That if that is, then what you would say then at that point is, I think it's mute, right? Mute? Moot. It's moot. It's mute? It's moot. Now I'm just saying the same word over and over again. It's not mute because you can hear me. But I think at that point, you know, the arguments become moot because what you have is a situation where there's so much runs that outweighs anything else. But I remember when Warne was playing, and for a long period that people would still go, players from previous eras would still go on about Tiger Bill O'Reilly. In fact, I told this story, I think it was on Footmarks the other day, that when Bradman was playing, people were still talking about Trumper. That's kind of how sport is. Where are we? Sega says, an average of 40 is considered good. If Marnus averages 70 at home and 36 traveling, why is that considered bad? If he reaches 40, that's still very good. Okay, so Sagar, thank you for your super chat. But the overall issue here is not that that he's not considered good. It's that at one stage he had one of the highest batting averages in the history of the game, and people were talking about him as a great. So what you get is then the overreaction from everyone else. But the truth is that a player who averages 70 at home is incredibly important, and you should always pick them. But a player who averages 35 away from home is probably, like, if you could get a player who averages 40 at home and 40 away from home compared to 60 at home and 20 away from home, the player who averages 40 away from home is probably harder to replicate than the player who averages 60 at home, right? You might not be able to get another player who averages 60 at home, but you might be able to get a bunch of other players who average 45 and 50 at home. Whereas the guy who averages 40 away from home, you probably find a lot of players who will struggle to get anywhere near that mark, right? That's why test cricket is so hard and test batting is so hard. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that when we are looking to go back to Mahela conversation, the Stuart Broad conversation, those sorts of conversations about players and Vass and many different players we've brought up here today, when you're talking about that next level, you are looking for not chinks in their armor, but things that separate them from other players who are incredible, right? You are getting to a point where you are, you know, if you're having to judge Marnus compared to Babar Azam, right? you do have to start looking at what they do home versus away with each other. And, you know, the David Warner one is a perfect example of what you're talking about. Of David Warner was on a trajectory of probably an all-time great. His runs away from home are probably what is going to stop him from getting there. And in the end, he's probably played on a little bit too long and also dragged his average down a little bit as well. But for a long period of time, he was averaging, high 40s. And a lot of that was from playing at home. And when he travels, it does drop a little bit. And you do see that he's a little bit more average. I think that's a fair thing of pointing out. If you're just saying if a player is good, then averaging 70 at home and, I don't know, 35 away from home is absolutely fine. But Manus wasn't on a trajectory of a good player, right? He was on the trajectory of a great player, and they are judged higher. He batted himself into that conversation. That's how it works. Shrikant, again, says, who should be rated higher? Someone like Warner or Rohit Sharma? Average of four. Oh my God, is this a similar question? Average of 45 at home and 30 abroad. Or Mark Waugh, who averaged 40 to 45 all over the world. Now, let me just look at Mark Waugh a little bit here, which I find a little bit more interesting as you've said that. I think it's harder to find players who can average runs away from home because I think if you would go to your first class system at any time, you've probably got a bunch of players who would do well on your kind of surface. Let us have a look at Mark Waugh. This is tricky because Mark Waugh sometimes watches these videos. So, sorry, mate, I probably will slag you off a little bit here. But so Mark Waugh's averages, let's take Sri Lanka out, which I've never seen, is hilarious. Also, UAE. The average is 12 in those two places. So Mark Waugh does not average less than 35 in any place. New Zealand is his lowest, which is about 36. Just 8 innings there, though, weirdly enough. But pretty solid all the way through, right? That, to me, is a player who is... means that you can pick them automatically in your side and they're always going to be helpful. He was a fine player in Australia. In some ways, Mark Waugh was a very Rahane type player in that he didn't go on to always make the big hundreds, but his hundreds were often very impactful. But as much as anything, Australia trusted him on every single tour, which meant that they had an automatic touring player. Now, could you argue that you could have picked a better player in home conditions than Mark Waugh, who might have averaged 45, 50, 55 in Australia and used him when he went away? I would argue yes. Now, Mark Waugh would probably say no, and maybe other cricket people might say no. They might say no. Well, he learnt to play against Test cricketers partly by playing at home, which I think is a fair argument. But from that, I think there's an even better way of using him. But your general question is that, and I don't know Rohit's numbers off the top of my head. I know Warner's because I looked them up recently, and obviously I've just looked at Waugh's now. But I would have thought that, you know, from that situation, that is a much better player who is of much more use to you than a player who can't do those things. Because with Mark Waugh, you know that when you're going to Asia, you have a good batter. You know, when you're going to England, you have a good batter. You know, when you go to South Africa, you've got a good batter, right? You know that if you go to India for a test series and they have a green top, Mark Waugh is still going to be handy for you, even if you didn't expect it to be a green top. You know, if you go to South Africa and it's a green top for 3 days and then it crumbles at the end, you still got Mark Waugh. Those sorts of players, I think, are far more use to you than a player who's very good at home, who probably is good in certain situations away from home, but isn't as well-rounded. And I do think that's something that should start to be factored in a lot more. That said, don't think Mark Waugh is going to make my top 50 greatest batters of all time. Sorry, Junior, if you are watching. AJP says, biggest talking topic today, overrates. What's your view? Khawaja put a tweet out. Look, what I'm going to say is the most important thing on this is that overrates are not just about bowling teams anymore. And I still think we think about them from a bowling team perspective. You know, concussion substitutes, batters getting drink breaks, all these different things that are happening at the moment. It's not just about bowlers, bowling teams. Having said that, first class cricket still seems to handle it a lot better than test cricket does. So I think we'll end up at a pitch clock. And the more these teams complain about it, I actually think the more they will make their life worse. Because at the moment, when you bring it up, you often get told that there's a big feeling now that the only people who care about it is the media. But the more and more that players keep mentioning it, the more it will be seen as a big thing. And I do think we'll eventually get to a pitch clock. Probably not in Khawaja's time. But there was no doubt that Australia and England, at times in that test series, were intentionally slowing the game down, right? They can't then turn around and complain when they're fined. They were intentionally slowing the game down. The England bowled 9 overs in one session. Pat Cummins took his shoe off in another session, right? And when, you know, was it Ben Stokes would say things like to the umpire, does the crowd not look entertained? Wait a minute. If you're bowling 80 mile an hour bounces with all the fielders out on the boundary and it's taking you 8 minutes to bowl an over, no, they're not entertained at the moment, mate. They are actually, you are ripping the punters who have paid off, right? So it is bullshit. It's different if you're scoring at 8 runs and over or you're bowling Yorkers and it's, you know, it is very different in those situations. I understand Stokes' logic, but this isn't just a bowling team issue anymore. And I think finding the bowling teams when the batters are pissing about all over and over again is a bit ridiculous at this point. We need to find better ways of doing things. Max says, Australian selectors are bad. They dropped Head because he's bad in India, but picked Warner in England and don't drop Finch. I'm not sure about the Finch one. I'll leave that. They didn't drop Head in India because he's a left-hander and he was going to have to go up against Ashwin and he'd been bad in India before. By that point, Warner was their opener all the way through. So Head was just coming back into the side. They weren't 100% sure on him. They didn't know if he'd be successful there. I have no problem with the Head one. Warner one's slightly different because you can make a fair argument based on what you've said that Warner shouldn't be the automatic opener. But I think with Head, they thought they had more middle overs options available to them. Whereas Warner, I still don't think they're completely set on whoever's going to be Warner's replacement. So I do think that is a very different way of looking at it. But your general point makes sense. Like, don't go horses for courses 1 minute and then don't go them another one. But that's how these things work, right? Like, if you think you have better people to back head up than you do Warner, you're going to make those decisions. Adil says, do you think at some point we'll see teams build batting orders based on height? I feel like Crawley and Duckett, he says, is partly due to their difference in height. Yeah, but they're also left hand, right hand, and also one, you know, drives and one stays in his crease. So I think it's not just height. I think it's the combination of all those different factors. I don't think test teams will ever do this. I think in T20 cricket, these are the sorts of things we should start to think about though. You know, can we put two openers together who one is very good against pace and one is very good against spin and one is very tall and one is very short. One stays in his crease, one comes down the wicket. One plays outside of stump, one plays off his stumps, whatever that may be. Because I think the more differences you can put in, the harder it is for the bowling unit. Keshav says, who's impressed, surprised you more, Crawley or Stark? Or Marsh? Probably. This is the problem of being an analyst, because I'm going to say Stark, and it's not the right answer. But it's Stark because I didn't think he would ever master the wobble ball. And it's Stark because he made himself relevant in a series that he hasn't been relevant in before. Crawley should be the obvious answer, but I don't think Australia bowled particularly well to him. And I think when they did bowl well to him, he didn't look very good. And Marsh, I almost put in the same area as Crawley. When they bowled full in at the stumps, I didn't think Marsh looked particularly good. When they bowled short and outside the off stump, I thought Marsh looked really good. If you bowl in the areas he doesn't like it, he doesn't look as good. I think you should probably do that more often. So I think that answers your question. What else do we have here? Jason Lanky says, do you think defensive fields would work against baseball? Well, we've seen them. I think you have to be smart with your... I actually like the fielders out for Crawley and Duckett early on in their innings, but then they changed the way they batted and Australia had to go back with them. But we've seen 7 and 8 fielders on the boundary for them at times. They're prepared for that. They've been thinking about that, and I think they've handled it fairly well all the way through. Rebel Wisdom has sent 2 super chats, and I think they want me to answer this question. I think this is right. How do you think England will do in Australia in 2 years and Australia in England next time? Some are saying that this was the last chance to win in England for some time. No, I don't. Well, Cummins is 30, Hazelwood's 32, and Stark is 34. So Stark probably isn't going to be bowling for Australia at 34. So you would want someone like Jai Richardson to take over that mantle and become a frontline bowler. I'm not as worried about the bowling, but I think that's fair. Nathan Lyon maybe gets replaced by Todd Murphy and will be more experienced by that point. So they'll still have a good bowling lineup. I have no idea what the Australian batting order will be in 4 years' time. So it's almost impossible. I don't know how anyone will say this is their last chance to win Australia for some time because we have no idea. I mean, it could be what? Mitch Marsh at 5, Cameron Green at 6, Aaron Hardy at 7, and some random wicketkeeper at 8. It's so hard to work out what the team is going to be like in that far away. England and Australia, what do we know? So if Jofra doesn't play and Woodie will be 35, maybe 35 or 34 and a half. I can't remember how old he is at the moment. You would have to think he's not going to be the same force. Jofra probably doesn't play as well. So are they still going to be turning up in Australia without a bowling attack that is perfectly suited for Australian conditions? I would say yes. Jimmy might still be playing as well. Batting, you know, Stokes's knee is an issue. Root should be fine. They still, I don't think Crawley is going to do very well in Australia with the extra bounce playing the way he does. Ben Duckett shouldn't make any runs. Like, when we're assuming these players are all going to be around, which I don't think is true anyway. So I don't see the England team traveling particularly well to Australia. And I'm not sure Australia's team will be as good in 4 years' time as it is now. But so many things can change. The last time in Australia in 2019, well, the last time that these two teams played in 21-22, no one was expecting basketball was going to happen. Things can change very quickly. Thank you for the super chat. And Kuzi says, who do you think of the next generation of Aussie youngsters in Shield cricket? You think we'll be playing the next Ashes series? Are you guys all... I feel like you're all on the same questions today. I think Jai Richardson's an incredible talent. I don't know if he counts as next generation of Aussie youngsters. Aaron Hardy, I'm really interested in. Obviously, Spencer Johnson has become a random name on everyone's list. I think he's played like four first-class games, played for Australia A. Did he play Major League Cricket? I think he might be in the 100. The batting, there's a South Australian batter who I've completely forgotten the name of, who I'm really interested in, made some runs last year. But I feel like over the last couple of years, I've always felt that. There's been one guy who's made runs 1 year and then doesn't make them the year after. Pekoski's still the best young batting talent I've seen come out of Australia. There's some 20-year-olds and 19-year-olds, I suppose, that are on their way through that are interesting, but no one seems to be making runs in Shield cricket anymore. You know, the bowling seems to be, you know, Lance Morris, obviously. They like Skekety as maybe a late sort of, you know, a late career sort of bowler. I'm trying to think, I feel like I'm missing someone from Perth who can bowl as well. You know, they've got some, I think they've got a couple of 27 to 31-year-old seamers who might do a Boland, Stuart Clark type thing, you know, like Joel Parris and Skekety and those sorts of guys. If they want to go down Tremaine, maybe, although Tremaine's probably a little bit older now. But if they want to try those sorts of guys, obviously Nisa's still around, although he's starting to move on a little bit as well. But yeah, I think, I think Hardy and is a really, really interesting one going ahead. And I suppose maybe someone like Will Sutherland is another interesting one. I'm not sure how Will Sutherland translates to Test cricket, but it does feel like after years of not finding any all-rounders, now Australia has all these all-rounders and they can't find anyone to bat in their top five. So does that mean that they go the England style, as I said before, and Mitch Marsh bats at five, and then you have Cameron Green at six and someone like Aaron Hardy at seven? I don't know, is maybe the best way of putting it, but it feels like there's more stocks in that and, you know, maybe having Will Sutherland at eight, having a specialist keeper at nine. Okay, they're not going to do that, are they? But there seems like there is something to be said for that kind of way of... So that could be a potential Australian team going ahead based on what we're seeing at the moment. I don't see a lot of top-order batting talent coming through in Australia. I think there's a lot of good 27 to 32-year-old kind of bowling talent. Maybe not as many 20 to 23-year-old bowling talent right at the moment. Obviously, Todd Murphy is very, very talented, and they'll use Kuhneman when they travel in Asia and places like that. So there is some young talent coming through. But, you know, the sort of Sangadoran era of batting just never happened, right? You know, you've got the young kid from Victoria who has a strike rate of 12. You know, those sorts of guys just don't look like they're going to be able to transmit over. I am interested in general in South Australian cricket, so, because after a long period of not being particularly good, there seems like there's a lot of interesting talented players coming through there. And, you know, there's a new all-rounder coming out of WA every 5 minutes. So I suppose those are the ones. But thank you very much to everyone for the super chats and everything else. I will be back again soon. What have we got? We've got a Red Inca tomorrow, which I think is with Usman on Wasim Akram. We have, you know, a bunch of other shows coming up. We'll probably do a Footmarks on Stuart Broad's career very soon. But I've doing some other stuff on the ICAC report, and baseball and cricket's relationship. I probably should have done that while Major League was on, but the Ashes got a little bit in my head. But thank you very much for everyone for supporting. Remember, if you want to support us, make sure that we keep making great content. Patreon is the best place of doing it. But Super Chat's also a huge help. So thank you to everyone for those, and I'll see you again next time. Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Bayram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Sainapayu and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandredi is the head of our YouTube content. Tired of editing your podcasts and videos because you are as lazy as me? Well, try using Memento FM, an AI-based service that cuts and dices, so all you have to do is hit post. Try Memento FM today.
Podcast Network.